Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Cyber bullies use social media to embarrass and harass others. The emotional stories of harassed youth have motivated cyber activists to fight back, sometimes using questionable means in their quest for justice. Emily Bazelon, a senior editor at Slate, recently wrote about this trend for New York Times Magazine. She's also the author of a book on bullying called Sticks and Stones, which will be out in paperback February 11th. She joins us now by phone from New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
No one likes a bully, but when it's out there in the open, you can do something about it. When it's done discreetly through social media, it's a lot harder to notice and fight back. When did internet bullying start?
You know, of course, that's a little hard to answer, but The moment when I think it really came to public attention was after the suicide of a girl named Megan Meyer outside of St. Louis. And it's an interesting origin tale because the main person accused of bullying and harassment was actually the mother of a former friend of Megan. So it's an adult instance of an accusation of cyberbullying. But I think that moment was when we realized how much damage people can do by tricking and confusing and being cruel to teenagers online.
What do we know about the prevalence of online bullying?
You know, there have been lots of studies done, and they tend to show numbers between 10 and 25% in terms of the number of kids who are both victims of this, feel like it's happening to them, and also doing it themselves. So we're not talking about something that is, you know, completely rampant and that all children are experiencing. But this is becoming a, you know, significant issue that has obviously drawn lots of attention.
And a lot of times it's just kids being kids and they don't realize what they're doing.
Sometimes that's true. Mm-hmm. And I think there can be a distancing effect online where because you don't have the same kind of cues for empathy that you can have when you're looking someone in the eye and you can see the impact of what you're saying, sometimes that means that kids will say and do things online that I think they would never do in real life. And there's a kind of strutting and trying out of a meaner persona than happens in real life.
So when did anti-bullying activists emerge online?
Well, that's been a phenomenon really, I would say, of the last year or two in a really organized way where groups of activists have been galvanized and energized and upset by particular moments where a story of sexual assault has a kind of cyberbullying component to it. So maybe a girl says that she has been assaulted and then there are these very compromising, humiliating pictures or video that circulate online. And people see those things and then the girl becomes real to them, and it feels like she's telling the truth. And if the authorities are not taking action, then sometimes activists step in.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Emily Bazelon. We're talking about an article she wrote for New York Times Magazine about the emergence of anti-online bullying groups. In your article, Emily, you profile a group called Op Anti-Bully. What's Op Anti-Bully? I know what anti-bully means. What does Op mean? And how did it get started?
Yeah, so an op is the word that online activists use for an operation.
Oh,
like
okay.
An effort to take action, basically. And ops can kind of very organically spring to life around a particular issue. Often on Twitter, people will start tweeting back and forth, and then they'll decide to kind of band together and do something. And so that was how Op Anti-Bully started.
People in Ohio are very familiar with the work of Anonymous when photos of a Steubenville, Ohio girl she was from, West Virginia or Kentucky, were circulated online suggesting she had been raped. Two of the teen perpetrators were convicted last March, and a member of Anonymous was credited in the online world for helping prosecute them in the court of public opinion. But he was also criticized. So what happened in that case?
Well, so this is a complicated case. Mm-hmm. It's a case in which the two boys who were convicted were actually arrested pretty quickly. So law enforcement was taking action. But there was a lot of foment online and accusations that there was kind of a wider widespread cover-up, maybe of other assaults involving other athletes in Steubenville. And a guy who at the time was anonymous, using the name KY Anonymous, he put out a call for evidence. And somebody sent him a video of some boys laughing about these rape allegations in a way that was really pretty ugly. And that, I think, was part of what made Steubenville into a kind of national story about rape culture. And so that was the contribution that KY Anonymous made. But he also got a reputation for being a glory seeker. The FBI raided his home over allegations that he was involved in some hacking. And so that was also problematic because that involves breaking the law and violating people's privacy. Mm-hmm. And then within Anonymous, he kind of came out with his real name, Derek Lowstutter, and started raising money for his legal defense online. And among people in Anonymous, that's pretty taboo. You're not supposed to try to personally profit from your association with the group. And so a lot of people in Anonymous got mad at him.
Going back to Op Anti-Bully, what sort of methods did they use to get the identities of and information on these bullies? Did they have to hack too?
There are people kind of associated with the group who have done some hacking. I honestly didn't ask them a lot of specific questions about this because it's all illegal, and mm-hmm. I sort of, didn't want to force them to tell me about things that could get them into trouble with law enforcement. But, you know, I think, in fact, what's more important to this kind of work, it's not direct hacking so much as tricking people into maybe giving you a password or some personal information. And then, honestly, a lot of it is just tracing the digital breadcrumbs that are publicly available that people leave behind. I think sometimes people, teenagers and adults, think that if they're using an anonymous handle on Twitter that nobody can trace their identity. But in fact, it's really easy, if you know what you're doing, to link one account up with another and find someone's real name.
So how effective was their method of publicly shaming bullies? How did it, you know, can you give us some examples of what they did? I mean, we talked about the Steubenville example. What are some others, and did it work?
Yeah, sure. Well, I wrote about a couple of cases in which they were remarkably effective, I would say. There was a girl in Nova Scotia named Rataya Parsons who said she was assaulted. Another story about a kind of humiliating picture that circulated. And she became really unhappy and depressed and very sadly committed suicide. And after that happened, a lot of, again, sort of discussion online about the fact that the police and prosecutors in Canada had not charged any of the boys she'd accused, even though there was this photograph that seemed like it would be child pornography and so illegal. And so a group of Anons put together Op Justice for Rataya, and it had some components of very traditional organizing in it, like public rallies. But there was also an effort to identify and out and expose the boys who Rataya had accused. And as Anonymous was working on that, some other evidence came in. It was sort of like shaking a tree. And then the police did, in fact, bring charges against two boys. So that was an instance in which, you know, the Canadian Ministry of Justice went from saying, look, there's nothing we can do, we fully investigated, to reopening the case, having the Prime Minister of Canada saying this seems like really serious criminal behavior, and then having criminal charges brought.
Emily, in what ways did Op Anti-Bully get in the way of the traditional justice system in some of these cases?
Well, you know, the police are not excited about having people floating around anonymously threatening to expose other people, potentially hacking into private accounts. I mean, that feels out of control to law enforcement. It's not something that, it's a form of vigilante justice. Mm-hmm. And the problem with vigilante justice is that it's either done carefully if the people involved in it are very cautious and thoughtful, or it can get really out of hand if they go a little wild. And that does not thrill the police because it makes the police feel like, you know, things are happening that they can't control. They don't know who they're dealing with, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I think that was definitely an issue in the Rataya Parsons case. And the police were making public statements saying, look, if you internet activists start posing a real threat, well, then we're going to come after you. So there's a real tension there.
Have the activists ever gone too far? You made the point early on that sometimes people test out the internet, you know, test out a tougher persona on the internet, a meaner persona, but they may not necessarily be that way. Have any of the retaliations gone too far?
You know, I'm sure they have, but I think one thing about this kind of activism is that it's all taking place, or at least often, it's taking place in the same medium where the bullying is happening. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you are being really awful on Twitter and you start getting a barrage of messages from people saying, hey, stop it, you know, even if they're threatening you or cursing at you because some of this stuff gets pretty raw, maybe that's not so terrible. Maybe, you know, okay, you're a teenager, but you're acting out in a way in this forum where you're kind of asking for it. So that stuff, I think you can kind of argue that maybe teenagers can that's not such a terrible form of mm-hmm. vigilante justice. When you start having teenagers, you know, exposed to their parents or their schools for their bad behavior, that's a little trickier. On the other hand, if you're one of these activists and you see kids saying terrible things, tweeting terrible things, sending that content to an adult in the community and asking them to intervene, you know, maybe that makes some sense.
Since App Anti-Bully officially disbanded, how are other hackers continuing their work? Is there any kind of formal group?
You know, I mean, I don't know of an equivalent to that group right this minute, but one will surely spring up. And what I feel very certain of, because of the success of some of these ops, is that, you know, from now on, whenever we see a story of sexual assault that seems like it hasn't been handled right locally, another example recently was in a town called Merrillville in Missouri. Whenever we see that, we are going to see internet activism, because these people who really, you know, for good or ill, see themselves as trying to help vulnerable people, they have this outlet and they have felt what it's like to have real power and impact. And so they will be back and we'll kind of see, you know, I think we need some more examples before we have a good sense of whether overall this is for the good or for the bad.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it, Emily. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Emily Bazelon, she's senior editor at Slate. She recently wrote about this trend of retaliating against online bullies for New York Times Magazine. We'll post a link of that article on our website at WOSU.org/allside. She's also the author of a book on bullying called Sticks and Stones. It'll be out in paperback February 11th. We will return with more Tech Tuesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Technology is automating more and more aspects of our everyday lives. The jetpack isn't here yet, but the driverless car may be just around the corner. As machines take over tasks once reserved for human labor, many wonder what the role will be of humans in the future. Two researchers at MIT say that we have nothing to fear, really. They've written a book on the topic. It's called The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Joining us now is co-author Andy McAfee. He's the principal research scientist at the MIT Center for Digital Business. He joins us by phone from San Francisco. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So what can we learn from the first machine age, the Industrial Revolution, and how can it be applied going forward to the second?
As you say, the first machine age was really the Industrial Revolution, the ability finally for human beings to overcome the limitations of their muscle power by using the steam engine and the internal combustion engine and a bunch of other technologies. And what can we learn from it? The first thing we learn is that, honestly, it's the biggest story in human history. It put us on a completely different trajectory of development and a much better trajectory. The Industrial Revolution was really good news for humankind. The second thing I think we learned from it is that it wasn't a completely smooth transition for everybody all the time. There were real challenges that came up from the first industrial revolution, child labor, pollution. We faced a host of challenges, but we dealt with them, and it made the world a better place. And that's the third lesson I take away. I think all three of those are applicable for the second machine age, the one we're in now.
It brought more efficiencies. We didn't have to use our muscles, but humans were still a lot more involved, and it seems like the Industrial Revolution created a lot more jobs. That's why people left the farm to go to the big city.
Well, it's a great example of what the economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction, which is the central thing that goes on in capitalist economies. We destroy things at the same time that we create things. We destroy industries and companies and, yes, jobs. But at the same time, innovation and entrepreneurship create new industries, new companies, new jobs. That's still going on today. Part of the reason Eric Brynjolfsson and I wrote The Second Machine Age was because we think the balance between the creation and the destruction might have shifted recently.
Yeah, in the first machine age, productivity, employment, and medium income all rose at about the same basic rate. But that's not the case in the second machine age.
And what's interesting is that if you look at the data for the entire post-war history in America, you notice that in the first few decades after World War II, we had this great run where output went up, productivity went up, job creation went up, and average wages went up, and they all went up just about in lockstep. They were just hanging together really nicely. These were great times for our economy, for our society. It led to the development of the American middle class, which is a great, big, important deal. Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, in the more recent decades, the data about output and about productivity are still on a pretty good trajectory. The data about job creation and about average wages are on a different trajectory. Actually, these days, a slightly downward one for wages, which is really troubling.
Yeah, two concepts you outline in the book are bounty and spread. Can you talk about those ideas and how you use them?
Yeah, the way to think about those is of those the divergence in those two kinds of data that I talked about. Bounty is more stuff. It's what the goal of an economic system should be, to produce more goods and services for people, higher quality, higher variety, lower prices. And our point is that the digital revolution that we're living in right now is doing a fantastic job of creating more bounty. And by bounty, it's really important. We don't just mean, you know, cheap plastic toys and empty calories. We mean better health care. We mean better communication and entertainment and leisure options and the things that really do enrich our lives. And to say it again, digital technologies are fantastic at generating that. So that's the good news. The challenges are about what we call the spread, the fact that inequality is rising. And when we look at outcomes that we care about related to people, how much money do they have? What's their average wage? What's their income? What's their social mobility? We see a much bigger distance between the top and the bottom now than we ever did before. And that's troubling. And that's what we mean by spread.
We know that after World War II, countries like England recovered a lot differently, and the trajectory for them was a lot different because they first had to rebuild. I wonder about the second machine age in our world, and where so much of it is at war and just completely messed up. How can it progress in those countries, or are we only talking about the United States?
No, what's fascinating is that all the phenomena that we talk about are global phenomena, both the bounty, which is great news, and the spread, which is bad news. Mm-hmm. When you look at the bottom of the pyramid, at the billions of people living on $1 a day, $2 a day, the great news is that their lives and their opportunities have improved remarkably just in the past couple decades. Things have gotten a lot better at the bottom of the pyramid. It's incredibly encouraging news, and there's a lot of great research that shows that digital technology has helped a lot with that. When you watch what happens, for example, when people get mobile phones mm-hmm. for the very first time, it is amazing how much better their lives get. But inequality is also going up in country after country around the world. The amount of total GDP that gets paid out in wages is going down around the world. So both the bounty and the spread are not just U.S. phenomena, not just rich world phenomena. Mm-hmm. They're global.
What technologies do you think will be the most disruptive to the economy and job market as we know it today?
It's a great question. It's really hard to answer because the crystal ball is cloudy in these times when there's this much innovation and disruption going on. But to me, the different forms of artificial intelligence are going to be hugely disruptive and are going to increase both the bounty and the spread. It is strange how much better computers have become in recent years at things like understanding what we're saying, realizing what we want, giving it back to us, recognizing patterns, diagnosing disease, doing legal work. Computers can even write clean prose now. They're not done showing off their abilities, and it's going to be both great news. We're going to have a lot more automated support for the things that we want, but this artificial intelligence is going to encroach on a lot of what people do for a living today.
Well, and, you know, obviously, if you're a science fiction fan like I am, it's kind of creepy, too.
There's a creep factor involved here. And Eric and I had the chance to ride in a Google driverless car two summers ago, and it went from being a creepy slash terrifying experience to being an incredibly interesting experience to being kind of a boring experience within about 20 minutes, because the holy Toledo factor goes away, and then you become incredibly interested in what's going on, and then it starts to feel like the ride on the monorail from your gate to the terminal at an airport, because the car is just such a boring, good, stable driver. I think we're going to see that over and over and over again, this holy Toledo to, oh yeah, here's another piece of amazing technology in the months and years to come.
What specific skills do you think future generations will need to learn in order to be successful, and which skills will become obsolete?
I like the way you ask the question. Very often when we hear it, it gets asked as what jobs or what careers are going to endure. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. We need to be flexible because we're going to skip around in our careers increasingly in the future. So it's what kind of skills do we need to have in our toolkit? I've still never seen a creative computer or an innovative one. So this concept of ideation or coming up with something new is incredibly important. Still seems to be a human trait. I've also never seen a computer that was a good manager or a good negotiator or could motivate other people. So these more deep interpersonal skills are going to be valuable for a long, long time to come. And in the physical world, robots are still really, really primitive. They can't walk across a room all the time. They certainly can't pick up a towel and fold it. I've never seen one that could soothe a child that was unhappy. So these kinds of skills are going to remain valuable for a decent period of time to come. What's interesting to me is that some of those skills are way up high at the end of the education and the end of the IQ range, and some of them are nice, are mid-skill, mid-range and low-range as well. So I don't think that people who are not blessed with an incredibly high IQ or EQ are doomed.
You know, I wanted to get back to the idea of ideation. We've heard amazing stories about dropping cell phones into the laps of children in developing or at-war countries, and the things they've done with them, or computers, and how they've come up with solutions to bring water to their villages or bring electricity and that kind of stuff. And it makes me wonder about, are we too top down in the ideation and in solving problems like that around the world?
Yeah, we almost certainly are. And the great news to me is, I mean this seriously, in the next few years, we are going to be doing what you just said, giving the powerful device, the phone, the tablet, the computer to someone at the bottom of the pyramid. We're going to do that billions and billions of times. In just a few more years, the majority of the world's population is going to be interconnected with each other, with processing power, with the knowledge that exists out there on the web. We really are going to interconnect the world's people for the first time ever. That is a big, big deal. And just like you, I'm really optimistic that when you put billions of brains to work and give them the potential to contribute or innovate, some of them are going to blow you away with what they can do.
It's kind of surprising how backwards our educational system seems on a day like today when school's been called off and millions of kids are not put it this way, but stuck at home doing nothing. We don't seem to really, the education system still doesn't really use the technologies out there to effectively teach.
In some cases, I think that's right, but again, I want to stress the optimistic side here. Kids who are motivated, kids who have motivated parents, have access to an array of educational resources that never, ever existed before, all the way from college-level massive open online courses down to Khan Academy and parallel efforts going on for younger people. The array of first-rate educational stuff out there, thanks to the net, thanks to computers, is astonishing. The problem, I think, though, is that if you're not a self-motivated kid, if you're not a self-starter, if you don't have those kinds of parents, those resources really don't do you very much good. It's a thorny problem and one we've got to work hard on.
Talking to someone the other day whose child, 3-year-old, operates their smartphone as if he was born with it. How much of the technology that we're using today is really being developed for people being born today?
I think what's going on is that the smart technologists in recent years really figured out how people want to interact with pieces of technology. And, you know, no surprise, it turns out what most of us don't want to do is type commands into an interface and deal with computers that way. It's pretty unnatural for most people. So the great technologists came up with touch screens and apps that make sense and icons and very, very intuitive interactions with digital technologies. That's why you see toddlers and little kids very, very fluently navigating around iPhones and tablets. I think that's a great development.
What ways do you propose, well, should government get involved to ease the transition as the jobs that we are used to disappear, and they're going to disappear, well, I mean, if the innovation occurs at the pace that it has been, they're going to disappear, a lot of them, fast.
And I think that's right. It's very difficult to say exactly how fast, but if this idea is right, if the second machine age does mean that technologies are going to encroach quickly, deeply, broadly into territory that right now is held by humans alone, then we do have a jobs and a wage situation to worry about. You ask about government intervention. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, we think there are things government can and should be doing. In the very short run, let's fix our infrastructure. Let's make this an easy environment for entrepreneurship, because entrepreneurs are the people that create jobs. Let's liberalize our immigration policies. Let's fix our educational system. This is in an Econ 101 textbook, things that government should be doing, and not enough of them are being done right now.
What about the bounty? Because, are you suggesting that the government spread the bounty around more?
What we're suggesting first is let's think of other ways to make sure that everyone has access to the bounty. I'm not automatically against higher tax rates on higher earners, but honestly, there's not enough money there to solve the problems of the middle class and the people at the bottom of the income range. So let's concentrate exactly on them, and let's think about ways to increase their economic opportunities, as opposed to focusing so much on the people at the very top. I just think that's the wrong place to focus.
So we have the idea people, the innovators, and then we have the people that can handle people, and those are pretty high. They're kind of at the top of the food chain in terms of thinking. What are we going to teach? What do we teach in school to achieve that?
We de-emphasize our current focus on following instructions perfectly and on mastering just the three R's. You know, on basic reading, on nothing but math skills, and some writing composition. The reason I like those less is because computers are getting much, much better at all of those. It's not where our comparative advantage is. So let's start being more explicit about teaching interpersonal skills, teaching ideation, helping kids think for themselves. Those are the people who are going to be valuable even as we head deeper into the second machine age.
How much do you think the first machine age cultivated that out of us?
I think...
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. The explicit goal of the educational systems we developed in the first machine age was to produce, one of the explicit goals, mm-hmm. was to produce workers for that kind of environment, for factories and office buildings around the world, and it did a really good job at that. The educational system was not badly designed for that place and time. It worked actually really well. My point is that it's not the right educational system for the world that we have today, let alone the one that we're heading into pretty quickly.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate it.
And thanks very much.
My guest, Andy McAfee, he is principal research scientist at the MIT Center for Digital Business. He's also co-author of a new book, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. We'll continue Tech Tuesday with Russell Holley when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday, and that always means we end the hour with Russell Holley. First, there was the floppy disk, then came the CD-ROM, and after that, we got the thumb drive. And these days, when it comes to storing data, it can all happen in the cloud. Lots of options. Russell Holley, welcome to the show, and thanks for telling us what those options are now. In 2007, Microsoft launched SkyDrive. How was that service received then?
It was received reasonably well. There was a few problems when it first launched because it didn't do quite as much as some of its competition, but it quickly, got a reputation for being one of the best services for Windows, especially.
So why did Microsoft have to change the name?
So there's this company in the UK called Sky Broadcasting, and they decided that Sky Drive sounded an awful lot like a service that they wanted to announce, but then couldn't because people would confuse it with Microsoft's product. And since they kind of owned the name Sky Broadcasting, they felt that Microsoft should go ahead and give up that name. And while Microsoft disagreed at first, eventually a lawsuit determined that Microsoft needed to change that name. So whether it is as willing as it sounds, SkyDrive is shortly going to be changed. It's really just a cosmetic change. The name change, a lot of the logos and everything are going to look very similar, but it's going to go from being SkyDrive to OneDrive.
I like SkyDrive better, but too bad for them.
I like SkyDrive better. It was a nice name. OneDrive pulls in a lot of the things that Microsoft is trying to do right now with the idea that, everything... all of their products are all kind of tied into one, especially with their most recent game console and the stuff that they've been doing with Windows 8, the phone operating system, and Windows 8, the desktop operating system. So it will probably be one of those things that we forgot was ever called SkyDrive probably in a year.
Do we know how successful SkyDrive/OneDrive is? How many users?
I don't have a recent set of numbers. They don't share it particularly often. They have a developers conference coming up particularly soon, and that's usually the time that they announce those kind of numbers. So we'll probably know very soon. But it definitely isn't as big as, say, Dropbox or any of those other kind of services. It definitely competes with Google's Drive service in terms of how many users and how it gets used. But one of the big important things about SkyDrive and what will now be OneDrive is how well it integrates with Windows 8. If you're a Windows 8 or a Windows 8.1 user, then keeping files on SkyDrive is a really beneficial thing. You get the 7 gigs free, and Windows treats it almost like it's a separate hard drive. So it ends up being really great if you're constantly accessing those files.
So that's the reason to switch if you aren't already there.
it's definitely a good thing to switch. It really depends on your use case. I'm personally a Dropbox user because I throw things up there and then I share them with someone and then they're gone. But if you use it more like a hard drive, like all of my documents get stored inside drive, if you decide to do that, then it's a way better setup than what Dropbox would offer.
Okay. Let's talk about the rumor mill. It looks like Google Glass might be getting some serious competition from Samsung. What are people saying?
So there was a patent filed by Samsung a while ago for a wearable computer, and Samsung has always kind of had their hands in everything. But the big thing right now is that later this year, Samsung is going to have an actual wearable computer that crosses both sides of your face and really looks like a pair of glasses that is designed specifically to either compete in the same space as Google's wearable computer or to act as another option that is with Google. It hasn't really been made clear yet. Google works with Samsung on a lot of smartphones. They have been partners for a really long time. They just secured a patent agreement with one another for 10 years. So it seems weird that they would be directly competing with one another.
Mm-hmm.
It seems probably more likely that when Google goes, okay, well, Glass is now available to the public, Samsung will just be like one of the versions, and it'll probably end up running a similar operating system. But we really don't know much of anything other than the pictures that are shown in the patent setup.
I was going to say, because we talk an awful lot about Google Glass for considering that it's not out there yet.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is because I own it, and so I touch it all the time.
Okay.
It's already a real thing. And unfortunately, you know, I do that a lot, where I'm kind of an odd future person.
But we hear about it a lot, too, out there.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's constantly things going on with it, mostly because the people who own them are troublemakers. We get thrown out of theaters and we get pulled over for driving too fast and all kinds of silly things like that.
Well, I sure would like to try one, but average people like, you know, like me, they can't just get them. You have to be special, like you.
Well, I think that may actually change before terribly long, but that's probably something that you and I would have to talk about later.
Do you feel that these types of devices will ultimately catch on, or will they remain niche?
I think that this generation of them, where they're still kind of quirky looking, they don't really look quite like glasses, I think that those are going to be kind of niche. But I really think that the next generation, where they slim them down a little further, they look more like glasses, and the idea that you would be able to operate in a hands-free environment, I think that concept will catch on.
It is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you have a question or comment for Russell Holley, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Russell kind of covers the waterfront when it comes to technology. So if you have a question about just about anything, you can give him a go. I think only a couple people have stumped Russell in the last 2 or 3 years.
And
so,
it's been a while. Yeah. Like that last one was a while ago.
I know. So let's say stump, the geek.com guy. 614-292-8513. Holy Toledo Xbox One fix. The battle for the best gaming system continues between the Sony PlayStation 4 or PS4 and the Xbox One. Tell us about why Xbox One has some catching up to do.
So when Sony and Microsoft released these consoles, calling them not quite fully baked is a bit of an understatement. Both Sony and Microsoft rushed really hard to get these consoles out, and they got them out, one right after the other. And they're out there now, and people are playing games and everything, but anybody who owns one can tell you that the experiences are not quite finished yet. And Microsoft is lagging just a bit behind as far as which one is able to deliver the best video game experience. A lot of it has to do with the extra things that are kind of attached to the Xbox One. And the biggest thing is the Kinect. It is, a big camera with a microphone that sits on top of your television and allows you to do some incredibly cool things as far as navigating the console and using your voice to control almost everything. Doing that in a constant way consumes a lot of processing power, and that processing power gets taken away from the time that you would spend playing games. So what Microsoft is going to do is release a patch that will make the camera part of the Kinect do a whole lot less when you're in the middle of a game, and that will free up that processor time and allow more of it to be dedicated to the game, which will provide a better overall experience.
What's a GPU?
That is the graphics processing unit. It's basically the thing that makes everything look nice and pretty.
And so the Kinect feature on Xbox has to do with that.
The Kinect feature on Xbox, the big thing that it does constantly is the camera is you know monitoring your body and keeping an eye on your bone structure so that when you raise both your hands up to do something, it's there to pay attention to whatever it is that you want to do and act on those commands very quickly. And that's really cool when you're you know navigating the operating system and doing stuff. But when you're actually playing a game, both your hands are down, you're holding the controller, you're not going to be you know kind of emergently lifting both your hands up to execute a command. It's just never really going to happen. But nevertheless, the Kinect is still constantly monitoring for you to make that gesture so that it can act quickly, and that consumes a lot of that processing power.
Tyler in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly from Geek.com. Welcome.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, Russell, I've noticed you mentioned Dropbox and SkyDrive, and I was just wondering if you've heard of the copy service from Barracuda Networks, which offers 15 gigs, and I was just wondering if you had any opinions on that.
I'm definitely familiar with copy from Barracuda. Barracuda has a lot of really cool services that are traditionally targeted towards enterprise solutions. So I don't end up mentioning it quite as often, but I know that copy is definitely a consumer-facing product.
Yeah.
It's not a service that I've spent a ton of time with. One of the big things that I found with it when I used it last was that the sharing solution was really awkward compared to Dropbox. I haven't been back in a little while.
Because the fact that it shares it between the two people sharing the information.
Right.
As far as the free space.
Tyler, could you repeat the whole question again?
Well, I was interested. He was mentioning the fact that SkyDrive offers 7 gigs and Dropbox is generally a 2 gig service, and Copy.com is providing 15 gigs. I notice it doesn't get mentioned as often, but it is a personal solution out there. I was just wondering if you had any opinions as far as service or quality of the service that's provided by that company.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call.
Not a problem. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
There's this big event coming up this weekend.
Is there?
Mm-hmm. Do you have your chips and dip ready? And
man, I couldn't possibly imagine what that event would be.
The Super Bowl! More and more people are watching TV online on their various devices instead of a traditional TV hookup. But for live events like that, that hasn't always been possible. This year, Fox Sports is going to change that. What's going to happen?
Well, so there's the idea is that the Fox is going to allow their website to be available for mobile devices and laptops and tablets that are all going to be able to stream the Super Bowl from their website. And if you have an iPad or, you know, an iPhone or the correct Android phone, it's not every Android phone, then the Fox app will allow the streaming as well. But essentially, it'll be as close to the same experience to the television as you can get right now, really. And that's going to be a big thing. It's supposed to work really well, but with any experience where you're streaming like that, the biggest thing that you're going to run into is your internet connection.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in an area where your data connection isn't particularly great, if you're trying to use your cellular service to stream the Super Bowl and you have a data cap, you're not running unlimited data, then you are very quickly going to run out of data, just because, especially if you're watching in a high-definition environment, that's going to consume a lot of data. So the service is available, but it's important that you be careful and use it in the right situation. Otherwise, you're going to get yourself in trouble with your mobile carrier.
Will you still have to watch the commercials?
You will still have to watch the commercials, and it's not been made clear whether Fox is going to have their own set of commercials or whether it's going to be the Super Bowl commercials. I would assume it is going to be the Super Bowl commercials just because that is one of the biggest things of this event. But typically with streaming solutions, they have kind of preloaded commercials for the streaming service. So it hasn't been made clear yet how exactly that's going to work. But that's going to be available.
Do you have any sense about, I've been listening to, I think I listened to a story on NPR yesterday about how interactive the Olympics are going to be because of the new generation. They're trying to attract people that maybe might not be watching it otherwise, and they're working on interactivity. Any sense about that with the Super Bowl?
They haven't said anything about interactivity, and this is really kind of a new area. The cool thing about the Super Bowl is that they intentionally open the doors up for as many companies to come in and do a lot of new things. And every single year, the Super Bowl has got impressive new technology behind it as far as watching and engaging. Whereas the Super Bowl, you know, the NFL has always been, you know, very targeted as far as how they want their content delivered. So they're a little behind the Super Bowl in terms of, you know, what kind of features are going to be available. I wouldn't expect interactivity to be a big thing this year, but it really wouldn't surprise me if next year is a big thing, especially since we've got groups like CBS who have a guy who's going to be at the game using Google Glass all this coming week. He's been doing it already, you know, posting videos through Glass where he's been exploring the ball that's going to be used and you know, going to be walking the field and doing a lot of things like that, where you'll have that kind of first-person perspective for a lot of that stuff. So interactive content is definitely something that is being, you know, kind of played with, but I don't think it'll really be a big thing until next year.
So there, you can go to CBS and see the stuff that this guy's doing with Google Glass?
Yeah, CBS has got some stuff. His name is John Cuco, and his YouTube channel has already got a couple of videos up, and he's going to be doing a whole bunch of stuff all week long with Glass. The first thing I noticed it this morning was he did a walkthrough of the ball that was made specifically for the game. It was kind of neat to watch this morning.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I was going to mention Siri from Apple in my last interview, because they were talking about how, oh, they can talk to you and how, you know, the next machine age and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, Siri, I still can't talk to Siri. But Intel has an alternative. There's an alternative to Siri out there, Jarvis.
Well, so Intel is working on a concept, and Jarvis is definitely not going to be the final name for it. Otherwise, Intel's going to have their own fun naming lawsuit, because Jarvis is actually the name of the companion that Tony Stark uses as Iron Man.
Okay.
And it's just kind of a play on words as far as what the name of the concept is. But the idea is that it would be a Bluetooth headset that would sit in your ear, and instead of relying on the cloud to send and receive information for voice translation, the computer would actually, you know, sit next to your ear, and that would be what is responsible for receiving your voice and executing commands. And it's a cool idea, but we send that information across the internet to cloud computers for a reason, and that reason is it takes really powerful computers to, you know, rapidly translate our voice into computer language so that those commands can be executed. So Intel really thinks that they have a competitor for Siri in this, you know, kind of hardware-only solution. And if so, it'll be really cool, but it's not something that anyone's been able to test yet.
Why do you think things like Siri are always female voices?
They're not female voices everywhere, and that's actually a really interesting thing. There are a lot of countries in the world where the idea of a female voice in that space is actually offensive. And so there are male options. I think Germany is one of the countries where having a female voice for Siri was actually a you know, a feature that they wanted turned off. And so in the last version of iOS, it was actually a male dominant voice for Siri that was available. So it's not true everywhere. I don't know why it's true here in the U.S. That would be an interesting question to have answered.
Yeah. Or whether you could change it.
You can't change it here in the U.S., and that was something else that I thought was interesting, was that those multiple voice options are available in those countries where Siri as a female was deemed offensive or deemed, you know, inappropriate.
Well, we have a few minutes left. How are you going to watch the Super Bowl, or are you not?
I am probably not going to watch the Super Bowl. It'll likely be on in some form or fashion, but that Sunday is usually the time that, you know, kind of our family gets around and kind of goofs off. So, you know, the it'll probably be on in the background so that we can watch the commercials and kind of laugh. I'm not particularly excited by either of the teams that are playing. I have friends that are very excited about the teams that are playing. But, you know, football has always been one of those things where I'm way more interested in playing it than I am watching it. So it's always been hard for me to get excited. Especially this year, because, you know, as a Baltimore resident, the Ravens didn't really do anything this year. So
I forgot.
That is.
That's right.
I'm sure that there's a really good reason that they didn't do much this year. I don't know what that answer is. So you can obviously tell that that sports are totally my thing.
Well, we're glad that technology is your thing, and we always appreciate having you on the show. Thanks again for your commitment to Tech Tuesday.
Thanks for having me.
That is Russell Holley. He's a tech blogger for Geek.com. We'll have that link on our website if you can't remember it at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.